Gary, I know you and I have been on a number of calls with the Department of Transportation and soaking a lot of this information in. There are a lot of nuances around the program, right? So there's a lot of pluses and a lot of nuances or hurdles. Welcome to Buzz House, a Baker Tilly podcast where you can hear all the buzz around multifamily housing with all the info you need to help you win now and anticipate tomorrow. Hi, I'm Don Bernards, the principal in charge of Baker Tilly's multifamily housing practice.
And I'm Garrick Gibson, a principal at Baker Tilly, also specializing in consulting on multifamily housing transactions across the country.
Let's get started. Garrick and I try to focus on trends and opportunities in the multifamily development space, and on today's episode, we're going to have a discussion of a few financing opportunities brought about by legislation or the government in general, right, with their various programs, as well as reiterate some other financing opportunities we have touched on, but seem to continue to have a place in today's development environment. We talk so much about interest rates and construction costs and insurance and what's out there to help move projects forward, so we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Garrick and I specifically are going to talk about, number one, the Build America Bureau Department of Transportation loan products, specifically the TIFIA and RIF programs. Really excited to get into that. Just a little refresher on essential function bonds and 501c3 bonds, which, of course, we've talked about on the podcast previously. And then just a little primer or snippet about the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, and we hope to have a couple of guests in the near future to get in a lot more detail. We, Garrick and I, see a lot of opportunities for multifamily properties with funding from the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. So to start with an overview of the TIFIA program that is through the Build America Bureau, Department of Transportation, and why Garrick and I think you should be interested in at least knowing about this program a little bit. To begin with, this program in general has been outstanding for a long time. It's been used by cities and other government entities to borrow money to build bridges and turnpikes and roads, things like that, right? It's through the Department of Transportation. But the administration opened it up to other economic development, which includes multifamily housing. That was just opened up in October of 2023. So really a relatively new program. And again, multifamily is an eligible use of these loan programs. So what is this program? What is the overview of the program? Just for starters, again, it's a guaranteed loan program through the United States Department of Transportation. So in a way, keep on your lands of almost like a HUD 221D4 a little bit, right? We'll get into some terms and underwriting, but think of that hat. And again, for starters, it's a guaranteed loan program, a federally guaranteed loan program. It is targeting, very specifically, transit-oriented development, which of course, again, makes sense with the DOT. A key criteria, which Garrick is going to address in more detail, is that, for starters, you must be within 1/2 mile of bus, passenger rail, or other transit. And again, there's a lot of details behind that, so we have a whole, Garrick's going to spend just a few minutes just on that definition, but within 1/2 mile. The interesting piece, and why a lot of people are interested in this, is the interest rate. The interest rate is pegged at the treasury rate corresponding with the term of the loan. So, for example, if you were looking for a 30-year term on your loan, I looked it up this morning, recording on June 24th, 2024, the 30-year treasury is around 4.39%. 4.39%. So today, that's almost 200 basis points below most equivalent type debt products in the market. Also, very interesting, for non-urban areas, it's really unbelievable. Non-urban areas for this program is defined as a non-urban area with a population less than 150,000. So not 5,000, 10,000, 20,000, 150,000. The rate is half of that rate. So if you had a qualifying loan in a rural area, today's rate would be about 2.20%. That's incredible terms, Garrick. It's incredible terms. Here, the TIFIA loan may be up to 49% of total project costs and can be in a co-first position. So that's maybe a little unusual, right? It's only 49%. So you definitely need, without a lot of other subsidy, another co-first. There can be up to a 5-year deferral of principal payments. It can be construction to perm. And again, the administration's approved. There's $70 billion of this approved in the budget. It's ready to be loaned to projects. A lot of nuances we're going to get into in the next few minutes. And Garrick, first I'm going to have you cover a little bit more about what type of transportation counts, right? We get a lot of calls. Hey, you mentioned bus stop. Does this cover any bus stop? Garrick, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Don, let me jump in, obviously, to give the listeners and begin to what actually qualifies in terms of that half mile transportation station. So basically, the starting point, think of like walking distance, half mile, the following. A fixed guideway transit, right? This is for TIFIA only, by the way. It's a fixed guideway transit, which means it could be a half mile from a bus rapid transit system, an inner city bus, or a light passenger rail. A bus rapid transit system is defined as a fixed route bus system that operates at least 50% of the service on an actual fixed guideway. These systems also have defined passenger stations. They typically have traffic signal priority or preemption. They're short headway bidirectional services for a substantial part of the weekdays and weekend days. There's usually low floor vehicles or low level platform boarding and separate branding of the services. And agencies typically use offboard fare collection as well. So I'm almost think of it as like a light passenger rail, but it's a bus and it's got these like dedicated lanes there. The inner city bus is any public or private bus service that provides regularly scheduled service that is open to the public using over the road buses that operate with limited stops between two urbanized areas or that connect rural areas to an urbanized area. And here's the kicker. It's where 50% of more of the passengers do not make the same day return trip. So it can't be like a shuttle, for instance. It's got to be like a true inner city bus here. And then obviously light passenger rail would be fine. And this is, remember, this is for the TIFIA loan. For the RIF program, it's only eligible for passenger rail. So this is understood to mean passenger service provided by actual railroad. And that term is actually defined in the code, right? So I would go read that. So in general, this includes a commuter rail or an inner city passenger rail service. And so think of a commuter rail, like it would include Maryland Area Regional Commuter or the Virginia Railway Express Service. So if you're familiar with that, that's kind of what it would resemble. And those are in the DC area. An example of an inner city passenger rail, think of Amtrak. That would count. Also, one other thing to note is your project must be revenue generating for the related transit or passenger rail station or service. So you need to show that your transit-oriented development is actually providing some type of ridership or some type of additional revenue to that station.
Perfect. Garrick, thanks for that detail for all of our listeners and so forth. Garrick, I know you and I have been on a number of calls with the Department of Transportation in soaking a lot of this information in. There are a lot of nuances around the program, right? So there's a lot of pluses and a lot of nuances or hurdles. Do you know, maybe we'll get into just a few of those nuances that we're digging into a little bit as we speak?
Yeah, I mean, we've obviously been looking at a number of projects and looking at the potential hurdles or challenges that you're going to face with multifamily projects, even, you know, multifamily with mixed use. The first is that the TIFIA debt program and any other senior debt, it obviously, this transaction must be rated investment grade. And obviously you would need to go to any of the numerous rating agencies and get this transaction graded at least BBB- or higher. And that's only for the TIFIA. So it has to be investment grade. You also need Davis-Bacon wages and labor standards that are required for the project. Obviously that's similar to a HUD 221D4. You also have to meet Buy America. So that required meeting, right? You need domestic sourcing of steel, iron, manufactured goods, and construction materials. This is an area we're starting to look at in more in depth with clients, and we'll keep our listeners updated on this topic.
Right. I know even with the solar, and there's a whole discussion of can we meet these? So I think there's even for this program, can we meet these? What does that mean? What's it mean for cost? So to Garrick's point, we will keep you up to date. A lot of that was, as we talked, was mostly on TIFIA. The RIF program, again, for rail, Amtrak included, things of that nature. Very similar in those Buy American, Davis-Bacon, everything that Garrick just mentioned on that. One difference is it still needs to have a investment review, but it does not need to make the or rating review, but it does not need to be investment grade because the one nuance is it does have the same base rate, which is tied to the treasury, the term you're looking at. But like a HUD 221D4, there will be a credit spread on top of that base. And so that's actually based on the actual transaction. So that's something to keep in mind. The other difference is, whereas TIFI was up to 49% of cost, the RIF program is up to 75% of cost. So probably be your only first mortgage in this place. And there's been, to date, $30 billion has been appropriated to the program. So this is, we hope to have more on this program in future episodes as well. As again, it's only October 2023 when it came about. No deal in the country, to our knowledge, as of this recording, has closed. There's a lot of dollars in the budget and interest rates that would probably work for a lot of projects. Garrett, one last thing. Would you be able to just talk a little bit about the process, timing, and so forth?
Yeah, sure, Don. You know, we've actually had a lot of calls from developers when we discussed this with them and noted they've had projects that are pretty much shovel ready or trying to close, and whether or not this would be a good option. And technically, the short answer is no. As the general process, think of a HUD 221 D4 process, if you're familiar with that, right? There's a pre-application, there's a presentation, there's actually an IRS review as well. There's a credit assessment phase and final application, and then you start working to closing. So this process is, you know, is estimated similarly to take 9 to 12 months. And so if you already have a shovel-ready project ready to go, you would have to alter your plans. So it is a long process, similar to the HUD 221 to 4, but obviously if you have a long lead time, this might be a viable option if you meet those certain requirements of being a half mile from one of those transit stations that I mentioned.
That's perfect. Garrick, switching gears, we've been looking at a number of both essential function bond transactions and 501c3 bond transactions. I know we talked this morning on one year modeling as we speak. Would you be able to give, and we also had attorneys and lenders as guests on the show before, but just want to give a few reminders out there to our listeners. Would you be able to give our listeners a reminder of what we're talking about in general with these bond programs?
Yes, Don. And in the big picture, right, these two types of bonds, you got essential function bonds and 501c3 bonds. They basically work in a similar manner, except one's primarily a government unit must own the property 100% versus a nonprofit that owns 100%, where 501c3 would be the nonprofit, the essential function bonds would be the government unit. A second possible difference is, depending on the nonprofit structure, there may be an affordability requirement with the 501c3 bonds, obviously meeting certain AMI restrictions. We're seeing for-profit developers partner with either nonprofits or housing authorities or even government agencies in both acquiring and renovating or delivery of new construction units. We're seeing projects potentially working for workforce housing developments because of that flexibility of that first mortgage term. You got longer interest-only periods, longer amortization terms, you got higher loan-to-value ratios and lower debt coverage ratios, and sometimes you tack on a B-bond or some type of subordinate debt. We're also seeing underwriting with even trending, such as a 3% rent growth and a 3% expense growth, instead of a negative trending that we typically see in a LIHTC deal. You may be asking, if you're not the only owner of the property, then how are you compensated? So we're seeing developer fees up front. You got ongoing cash flow through asset management fees being paid to you as a program administrator. If you bring the project to, you know, a nonprofit or a government agency, this B bond could be part of how you're extracting sort of the real estate value without actually owning it when they go through a refinance and paying you attractive, you know, tax exempt interest rate. So obviously, you know, you and I are currently helping underwrite a couple of 501c3 deals and essential function deals at the moment. So we hope that this trend will continue.
Very good. Now we're going to switch to our final topic for today's episode. And that is a lot of you probably have heard a lot about it or seen snippets of it, but is the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. And again, we are planning on a few follow-ups to this to get a lot more details on how these can really be effective for your project. In general, right, there's $27 billion awarded in three different buckets. And so Garrick and I are going to give you an overview of those buckets. One of these buckets is the National Clean Investment Fund, which awarded $14 billion to three applicants. Those three applicants, or three awardees now, are Climate United Fund, Coalition for Green Capital, and Power Forward Communities. The program in general has three priority areas for funding. Those are retrofitting existing and constructing new net zero buildings, also supporting zero emissions transportation, And lastly, investing in distributed energy generation and storage. So not all, you know, construction. We believe a big chunk of this will be going to construction, and obviously housing is a great use of that. And at least 40% of this capital in this fund must go towards low-income and disadvantaged communities, again, aligning very well with your affordable housing developments. Derek, would you please be able to touch on the other two buckets?
I certainly can, Don. There was also $7 billion awarded under the Solar for All program to 60 entities, some of which are state-specific and others cover, you know, a broad area. So those funds must be used for the delivery of residential rooftop solar and community solar, enabling upgrades and associated storage for that. Capital will be available to community as grants, loans, and other financial assistance. And like the Clean Communities Investment Accelerator, all capital available through the Solar for All is designated for low-income and disadvantaged communities. And finally, the other bucket, there was $6 billion being channeled through five awardees for the Clean Communities Investment Accelerator. Capital available through the program is dedicated to low-income and disadvantaged communities again, and that accelerator will create hubs that provide community lenders working in these communities with capitalization funding and technical assistance to support the deployment of those distributed energy, net zero transportation projects, and net zero buildings. So, you know, a lot of good stuff there. I like to see that those funds start to trickle down and get realized.
Right, exactly. I mean, we're right. They just are out. A lot of these awards, I think they just came out in April or May of this year, and right, putting their programs together officially. So as to Garrick's point, we hope to see some of this money committed late summer into fall, and perhaps even hitting the street in 2024. For sure in 2025, which of course aligns with some other rebates and things like that. So we'll talk a lot more about this, a lot of dollars, $27 billion, a lot for low-income communities. Very excited about it. That is it for today's episode of The Buzz House, where Derek and I ran through a number of alternative financing opportunities, which could perhaps move projects forward today when we know a lot of projects are facing, you know, hurdles and getting towards closing. Once again, I'm Don Bernardins.
And I'm Garrick Gibson. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. For additional resources around multifamily housing, check out BakerTilly.com. If you have a suggestion for the show, email us at buildabakertilly.com. That's BUILD@BakerTilly.com. See you next time on Buzz House.